Welcome back to Brain Biohacking with your host, Kayla Barnes. We dive into all things optimal health, optimal brain health, nutrition, peak performance, cognitive excellence, biohacking, longevity, and so much more.
Dr. Casey, it is such a pleasure to have you on my podcast today.
Kayla, I'm so excited to be here. So good to see you.
Oh, it's so great to see you too. And we're going to be talking about such an exciting topic, all things metabolic health and good energy. For people that aren't familiar yet with you, will you talk to us a little bit about your background? You have such an interesting story.
Yeah, absolutely. So I trained in the belly of the beast, a conventional healthcare, Western medicine. I got a medical degree and ended up training to become a head and neck surgeon. So I was doing ear, nose, and throat, head and neck surgery. And about 5 years into my training as an ENT surgeon, I had essentially like a total awakening, I would say, where I was just about to launch out into the real world after 9 years of training and take a sort of faculty job as a head and neck surgeon. And I realized that I was like, I feel incredibly confident and very competent being a surgeon. I know how to like diagnose patients. I know how to prescribe pills. I know how to like give them all their steroids and antibiotics, their sinus infections. I know how to do the surgeries. But what I realized is that like I actually had no idea what was actually making my patients sick. And I know this sounds kind of crazy because it's like, what do you mean? You're a doctor. But it's hard to overstate how much of an overt blind spot it is in the Western medical system that we become these almost like robots that just look at like symptoms and lab markers. And if they meet a certain pattern, we put a diagnosis on it. And then we attach a pill or a surgery to that diagnosis. And we write the chart note and we bill for it and we schedule a follow-up. And that's really what you're doing every single day. And when it really came home for me, it was with this patient. I remember very vividly, I was doing a rotation of sinus surgery. So it's like 10 sinus surgeries a week. And I was with this woman. I talk about her in the book. Her name's Sophia. She was in her 70s. She was back for her third revision sinus surgery. She'd been on a million antibiotics, a million steroids, nasal rinses, et cetera. And we were about to do this surgery on her. And she had all these other issues, like so many other Americans. She had high blood pressure and she was a little bit overweight and she had prediabetes and she had some depression and some pain and all these things. And I'm just about to do this surgery. And I'm like, what are we really doing here? Like, do I really believe that busting another hole in this woman's skull and sucking sinus pus out of it is literally the thing that's going to make this patient's life healthy and make her thrive? Like, what is going on? Are all her conditions potentially related? Like, I know sinusitis is inflammation. I also sort of know that obesity is inflammation. Like, are these related? And when you're standing over a patient about to do surgery on them and you have like a feeling like that, it sort of like put me down. It launched me on this road of like, what is really like the root cause of what's causing people to be sick? And like, why are we not approaching health at that level? And I think once you start asking those questions, like, it's kind of impossible to go back. Like, it's like the cat's out of the bag and you start digging down that sort of more precision medicine, functional medicine approach. And you literally can't turn back because what you realize is that it's like, it's this world that we are living in is so radically different than it has been in the past 100 years. Things have changed so much compared to all of human history. And our cells are essentially responding and rejecting the environment that they're exposed to right now. And that rejection manifests as all these symptoms and diseases that we have. Because when you really dig into so many of the diseases and symptoms that are plaguing Americans today, they fundamentally are actually rooted in the same thing, which is metabolic dysfunction, mitochondrial dysfunction, essentially what I call in the book, the bad energy trifecta of mitochondrial dysfunction, oxidative stress, and chronic inflammation. If you take almost every killer in the US from heart disease, stroke, Alzheimer's, dementia, cancer, type 2 diabetes, other more non-lethal but annoying symptoms in the US, polycystic ovarian syndrome, infertility, erectile dysfunction, migraine, chronic pain, depression, anxiety, gout, and you really dig into the research, they all have these common shared links. And so the wake-up call for me so far into my conventional training was that I literally had no idea what mitochondrial dysfunction, oxidative stress, or chronic inflammation even meant. I didn't know exactly how the environment related to those, but I knew I had to learn that because there was such a strong link. And I really just started wondering, like, why the heck are we not focusing on treating those things and helping patients improve those things as opposed to just playing whack-a-mole medicine with all the downstream symptoms in all our little specialties that just focus on the downstream outcomes. So that led me on a 7-year journey that I've been on, which is really becoming a metabolic health evangelist, really studying more the systems biology perspective of how all these different conditions and diseases we're facing in the US that have been going up rapidly over the past 50 years, how they're linked together, creating a company Levels Health, which helps people understand their metabolic health and really take ownership of their metabolic health through the use of continuous glucose monitors, and then write this book, Good Energy, which is really like a call to arms, a manifesto for the healthcare system to say, we have to shift our focus towards what's really causing disease, not just playing whack-a-mole symptom management, because it's not working. The more money we spend on healthcare, the sicker Americans are getting. The more studies that we literally publish, the sicker we are getting. The more specialties in healthcare we invent, the sicker we are getting. So obviously we're not focused on the right problem, because the more investment we're putting into it, the worse the outcomes are getting, which is the definition of unsustainability. And if we pointed the arrow towards what's really causing the problem, we could wipe away so much of this suffering, I think, in a handful of years. But it really takes a wake-up call for the medical system to shift its focus and to kind of get out of that haze that I was living in for so many years.
Oh my gosh. I just love your passion for this topic, hence why we are friends. But man, it's so much to break down. So first, I want to go back to like the actual training of MDs, only because, you know, I think that so many people are just blindly following their doctors these days. The doctor said to do this. The doctor didn't ask me any of the questions. He didn't say to change my diet. So why is it, or like walk us through how it seems so mind-blowing that you would go to medical school? And I know that it's true, because I would say 75% of my friends are doctors, but how do they just skip over that completely and don't focus on any of the lifestyle factors?
Yeah. So I'll just kind of run through like what I recall from sort of medical school, from the structure. There's essentially like, it's broken down, at least this is how it was at Stanford, into like modules. So you have, first of all, like from the get-go, this is actually it's a great question that you ask, because it's kind of getting at like, what is the root cause problem of the medical system and like how it's training us. Even the way the curriculum is designed is an example of the problem. It's separated into organ systems. So it's like a month of kidney, a month of liver, a month of heart, a month of neurology, a month of musculoskeletal. And so that's like the first couple of years, is literally just working through different parts of the body and then studying them from all sorts of angles. You'll study them from histology. So looking at those tissues literally under the microscope and looking at what those cells of that part of the body look like. You'll study it from a pharmacology standpoint. What are the drugs that you need to know about in relation to the kidney or the brain or the heart or the liver? You'll study diagnosis. So if a patient comes in with these symptoms and these lab tests, what does that mean? How do you attach a label? So everything is very reductionist and very much focused on separating the body into all these parts and actually identifying the disease based on symptomatic criteria. So this is radically different from like a root cause perspective that would look at instead, how is it possible maybe that, like, it's just a whole different way of looking at it, that actually all these cells we know actually have very similar intracellular signaling pathways going on. And there's core pathways that actually are happening in every cell in the body. And how are those potentially related to these diseases and just showing up in different cell types and different organs as different things? Even the structure of the curriculum doesn't allow for that, because it's all about more downstream effects. And I think a key point for people to internalize is that, because people might say like, oh my gosh, how could polycystic ovarian syndrome and Alzheimer's be related? How could gout and cancer be related? How could arthritis and type 2 diabetes be related? They're totally different. But there are 200 plus types of cells in the body. We start as one cell, remember, and one fertilized cell, and that differentiates into over 200 cell types. You've got retinal cells, you've got, you know, astrocytes in the brain, you've got endothelial cells of the blood vessel lining, you've got hepatocytes, you've got all these different types of cells. And inside each cell, fundamental core processes have to happen no matter what, no matter what cell type. And one of those is the production of energy, metabolism. You need to produce energy in each cell so it can power itself to do its job, like a little machine turning the lights on. So if metabolic dysfunction is happening in the cell because of mitochondrial dysfunction or excess oxidative stress, that cell isn't going to be able to convert essentially food energy like glucose to, or fat, to energy it can use to power the cell, ATP. And so that one problem that's fundamental to all cells will end up looking like so many different symptoms based on what cell type it's happening in. So an underpowered cell in the liver could look like liver disease. An underpowered cell in a heart myocyte could look like heart failure. An underpowered cell in the brain could look like Alzheimer's. It could look like chronic pain. It could look like depression. It could look like anxiety. It could look like a migraine based on where in the brain that's happening. So through that framework, the whole curriculum of medical school could be like more focused on core physiologies. And so maybe there would actually be a quarter on mitochondrial dysfunction. And then we would study what that looks like in different parts of the body. But instead, we start with the parts of the body and silo out all these different diseases because, and a big root cause of why is because when we were originally describing these diseases, you know, 50, 100, 150 years ago, we didn't have the technology or the understanding to know about some of these intracellular signaling processes. So the whole concept of looking at the network of diseases and how they're related wasn't really possible. We described diseases based on their symptoms, and we just never updated that to a new framework. So of course, if you're describing a disease based on symptoms, liver disease and brain disease are different. If you're describing those diseases based on underlying physiology, they're actually the same, showing up in different parts of the body with a different look. So that, I think that's one of the ways that med school really screws up is by fragmenting the body so much. And like I mentioned earlier, it's astounding to me that to rise the ranks in healthcare today, it essentially necessitates that you become more specialized. You know, I was a doctor, then I was an ear, nose, and throat doctor. Had I gone on and done a fellowship, I could have literally just been a nose doctor, a rhinologist, or an ear doctor, an otologist. So that's now 4 years of medical school, 5 years of residency, 2 years of fellowship to literally focus on 2 square inches of the body. And actually, it becomes a liability to think about any other part of the body because you're no longer specialized in that. So you are laser focused thinking about your cells and what symptoms they have and just totally missing the forest for the trees of true biology. You're a pattern recognizer rather than like a true curious biologist. So it's built in from day one. Couple that with the fact that a huge part of med school endowments come from the pharmaceutical industry, and everything about the way that we set up the medical prestigious sort of hierarchy, you know, even the way we talk about the hierarchy of evidence that medical students learn, you know, what's the top of the hierarchy of evidence? It's randomized, controlled, placebo-controlled, double-blinded study. But if you think about it, that inherently pushes us to think that pharmaceutical studies are at the top of the pyramid because you can't do a double-blind, placebo-controlled study about whole food nutrition or about exercise, really, because people know what the other intervention is. There's no placebo. And so everything about the way the culture of healthcare, the way it's been funded, the way it's been financed, fundamentally has just created a compromised system where we just think that, of course, drugs are at the top, and we are a fragmented, separated part of the body, and separation is actually of paramount importance. And we just totally miss the links because we're so busy thinking about our hyper-specialization.
It's so It's so wild to me. Maybe I've just been in and around functional medicine for too long now, but it seems so obvious. Like the same, it is all connected. It's the same blood. It's this, if you have inflammation, it's the same inflammation throughout the body. It's just so mind blowing to me that it is so segmented. And wow. Well, thank you so much for walking us through that, because I really do start, I'm starting to feel a shift of people wanting to take control of their health, because as you know, and I would love to for you to speak to it a little bit more, but we have the worst health outcomes. We spend the most money, and yeah, people are sicker than ever. I don't know what the fix is other than for now seeking out your and being, you know, your own advocate in healthcare and finding your own doctor. Unfortunately, a lot of people ask me like, well, where do I find someone? And, you know, functional medicine is expensive. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. But do you think that the system's ever going to change, or it's just too big of a problem right now?
I think there's, you know, I think the system as it stands now with the current financial incentives and the fact that healthcare is both the largest and the fastest growing industry in the United States. And so because of that, because it's paying so many people's bills and so many elected representatives, such a huge part of their state is employed by either healthcare or big food in some way, food production or manufacturing, there's very low leverage right now to basically make changes because it's such a huge part of the economy and it's employing so many people. And unfortunately, like, I think it can feel scary to say, but I think it's important for everyone to realize the stark economic reality that every health institution in America today, you know, from hospitals to doctor's offices, medical schools, pharmaceutical companies, even insurance companies, they make more money when you are sick and they make less money when you are healthy. That's just a statement of economic reality. And I honestly, I know just like you, so many of my friends are doctors, and I don't know a single doctor who is what I would call like a bad person or went into medicine to be exploitative to patients. I think everyone went into medicine to do good and to try to help people. But those $4 trillion of interests that are based on more growth, if there are more patients sicker for a longer period of time, having more things done to them, that is the business model. There's so little incentive to change it. So we talk a little bit about in the book about like how would you shift this? And I think actually there's a few like simple things that I think that could happen from the standpoint of just like policy that would actually make like a really big difference. We talk about one, which is like we could literally, there could be an executive order tomorrow that pharmaceutical companies can't actually advertise on mainstream media. Most countries in the world don't allow pharmaceutical companies to just advertise willy-nilly to customers on TV. And right now, 60% of the advertising dollars that go towards like our major news outlets comes from pharmaceutical companies. And I think something to really, really recognize is that in that situation, the customer of the news organization is actually the pharmaceutical company. It's not the viewer. So it is going to change the way the news organization talks about what interventions are the most valuable. And we've seen so clearly that when you look at independent media, what are they talking about? They're all talking about empowering health messages, functional medicine, precision health. You look at mainstream media and it's pushing a single line of thinking around vaccines and drugs and Ozempic, and it's a laundry list of drugs and very dismissive of dietary and lifestyle habits. And that's because their bills are paid by the pharmaceutical industry. So an executive order actually saying that needs to stop, I think would change things overnight. I think that we need to ban NIH researchers or academic institutions that accept federal funding from also taking money from the pharmaceutical industry. It just makes no sense to me that taxpayer-funded organizations like the NIH should be also taking money from pharmaceutical companies, because again, when the bills are paid by a company that has an interest in certain research findings, like that's gonna impact the outcomes. We know that's true. We know that when companies that manufacture and use sugar do studies about the nutritional outcomes of their foods, like sugar-sweetened beverages, the outcomes are completely different than and show very different levels of harm from that sugar and those sugar-sweetened beverages than if those studies are done by a group that has no financial interest in sugar. So I think there's just like some simple things like ban processed food marketing to children, ban pharmaceutical advertising on, you know, on news outlets, currently 60% of their budget, limit NIH researchers and academic institutions that take federal money from being also getting funding from pharmaceutical companies, obviously reform the farm bill so that it's not financially incentivizing commodity crops. And what that would do, I think, is trickle into a whole change in the system where we're not just at the grip of a very particular way of looking at health, which is extremely linear. It's like symptoms, labs, diagnosis, pill. It would change things and open it up to be a lot more nuanced. And it would trickle down to completely change medical education because there wouldn't be a stranglehold on the institutions that teach, you know, our future doctors. One thing that my brother and I talk about is that like this is not going to be policy that's going to be passed through Congress because everyone is so compromised. These would have to be, I think, executive orders. The president would need to have to sign these and make it simple and make it clear because there's just so little leverage to create any sort of bipartisan agreement on this stuff. But I think we need some really strong moral leadership, you know, and I think someone like RFK, he's the first president in my lifetime, or presidential candidate in my lifetime that I've heard talking about these issues super, super plainly, which is very heartening. Mm-hmm. So he's the most popular independent candidate, I think, in the last 100 years. So clearly, I think there's something happening, but it's going to take some strength for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've had some conversations with him and had him on my podcast. I mean, again, it's just like everyone should be thinking this way. And it's amazing that he is. And I know for sure he would just go in and, well, I can't say for sure, but, you know, his goal would be to just clean everything up quickly. And it wouldn't be that big of a task if you just said, you know, you can't put harmful known carcinogens into food. You can't, you know, market pharmaceuticals on every other commercial. I mean, this is not really rocket science. It's like very simple. It's just not easy. And I'm so glad that you and your brother and, you know, there's people now really bringing light to this. And that's just so important because it's also just so sad. Like at the rate that we're going, I feel like there's just going to be a continued discrepancy between, you know, people that can afford organic food and then people that cannot. And that's just wrong. And it's just so sad.
It's so sad. It's so sad. And I think the real people losing here is our children. You know, the children today, mm-hmm. they're not going to outlive their parents. Like the children today are going to live shorter lives than the generation before them in the wealthiest country in the world. That's when we start letting down our children, I think it really shows the sign of like a cracking civilization. When we can't protect our children, we can't come together to keep refined added sugar and toxic pesticides out of the federal school lunch program. You know, when like 40% of 18-year-olds like have a mental health diagnosis and 50% of children are overweight or obese and 77% of young adults are unfit to serve in the military and 20% of young adults have fatty liver disease. Like it's just devastating. And I just look around, I'm like, the adults have total control over it. The kids are not buying their own food. Like what are we doing here? So I think that's so much of what motivates me at this phase in my life, you know, being around so many young kids with my friends and family. And it's just devastating to see how we're letting the children down.
Absolutely.
And profiting off their illness. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, absolutely. I want to talk a little bit about labs, standard ranges versus optimal ranges. If you wanted to actually ask your doctor, and I've seen this many times, a lot of times doctors just simply can't or won't call in specific labs, but when it is specific to metabolic health, what are you looking for?
Great question. Well, I think for people listening, like the first thing I would just say is that even if you have like the five basic biomarkers that define metabolic syndrome, which pretty much will come free on a standard physical, you are so much farther than most people in understanding your metabolic health. So these five biomarkers are fasting glucose, HDL cholesterol, triglycerides, blood pressure, and waist circumference. And essentially to be what we would call metabolically healthy or more optimally metabolically healthy, it means that all five of these biomarkers are in the normal range, not on medication. So that would be fasting glucose less than 100, triglycerides less than 150, HDL cholesterol above 40 for men or 50 for women, blood pressure less than 130 over 85, and a waist circumference less than 35 inches for women and 40 inches for men. So go look at those results, get a tape measure out if you need to do your waist circumference. And if all of those are in that normal range, not on medication, then you are part of 6.8% of American adults who essentially meet the criteria for what we call metabolically healthy. Not to make it discouraging, but I think you would probably agree, like a lot of those ranges are actually still very lenient. Like triglycerides mm-hmm. less than 150 is quite lenient. Like I would love to see people's triglycerides so all... It's really high, but that's what the metabolic syndrome criteria is. So really, I'd like to see triglycerides less than 100, maybe less than 70. I'd like to see fasting glucose between 70 and 85 instead of all the way up to 100. HDL more between 60 and 90 instead of above 40 in men, 50 in women. So it's interesting. If you actually took like truly optimal ranges for those five core metabolic biomarkers and you met all those criteria, I bet we're getting down to like 1-2% maybe of American adults. So, but with that said, like if those are all in the normal range that I defined, that's a sign that like the cells are probably doing okay from a standpoint of how they are converting food to energy. Because each of those biomarkers actually tells you something about the physiology of metabolic dysfunction. So that's sort of the basics. And then I would say from there, it's really the sky's the limit. And the book talks in extensive detail about what tests I think are most valuable. A couple that I would mention, and these are ones that you're more likely going to have to ask your doctor to order specially or order them from a specialty lab company like Levels or a Function Health or Inside Tracker or through your clinic, Kayla. But this is things like fasting insulin and uric acid. And I love liver function tests, AST, ALT. I really like GGT. The liver is just like such a critical metabolic organ. And if those cells are in any way metabolically dysfunctional and filling with fat and getting damaged through insulin resistance, your liver function tests are going to go up. So that's really good to check. HSCRP, which can tell you about inflammation, one of the three hallmarks of bad energy. I love, of course, you know, it's always good to know your LDL. And ideally, if you can get an advanced cholesterol testing, an NMR fractionated test, that's mm-hmm. going to give you not only the LDL, but also the fractionated portions of the LDL. So, you know, the more dangerous type, the small density LDL, and the less dangerous type, the high density LDL. So those are some tests that I like a lot to give sort of a more like well-rounded picture of metabolic health. And if I had to choose just one of those, I would probably choose fasting insulin as a test to just make sure everyone gets. Because if fasting insulin is in an optimal range, which I would consider 2-6 or so, or really 6 and below, you don't want insulin to be zero because but it can get close to zero. You want to be producing it, but you want it to be low because that's going to be just a really beautiful sign that on the very inside of your cells, you know, you've got your cells, and then inside the cells, you've got the mitochondria. And if that mitochondria is working well, converting food energy to cellular energy well, not getting backed up, not getting damaged, really a good workhorse, then the cell is going to keep allowing glucose to come into the cell to be processed because the mitochondria are working well. It's when they're damaged, and the mitochondria can be damaged from so many aspects of our modern diet and lifestyle, from chronic stress, artificial light, ultra-processed foods, environmental synthetic toxins, not getting enough sleep, not moving enough, not having enough muscle mass. So many things can really hurt our mitochondria. When any of those are damaging this precious structure, the body's not going to be able to convert that glucose to ATP as effectively. It's going to block the cell from trying to take in that glucose because it can't process it effectively. And two things are going to happen. A lot of that glucose is going to be converted to fat because it can't come into the cell, and then triglycerides are going to rise. And the body is going to pump out lots more insulin because the body, insulin is the hormone that helps the glucose get into the cells. And if the cells are saying no, essentially putting up an insulin block, insulin resistance, the body's going to churn out lots more insulin to try and drive the glucose in. So what you'll see is that rise in triglycerides, that rise in fasting insulin. So with these, with these biomarkers, you can really, with just a few simple biomarkers, you can kind of read the tea leaves of how much duress are the cells' metabolic pathways under. And then when people find that they actually give their body the signals that help their mitochondria thrive, so lifting weights and intermittent fasting and avoiding all the ultra-processed grains and sugars and taking out the toxic chemicals from their personal care products and getting enough sleep and managing their stress, doing all the things that make the mitochondria happy, of course, those biomarkers start coming down. The insulin comes down, the triglycerides come down, the fasting glucose comes down because things are flowing through the cell metabolically in a much better way. So those are some of the biomarkers that I really, really like for sort of a general metabolic assessment. Any faves I missed that you really love?
No, that's a really great start. I mean, obviously I take it to like the nth degree and of course do levels, continual glucose monitor and yeah, really just dive in. I just did a lab. I did it on last Saturday. I had 17 vials of blood drawn and I know everything. And yeah, I'm only looking at the optimal ranges. Doctor, how are standard ranges developed? Where do they get these numbers?
That's a great question. Typically, from my understanding of many of the standard reference ranges, it's looking at the mean, and I don't know if this is the case for every lab, but I know it is for some, like the mean of what people in the population have, and then looking at sometimes two standard deviations away from that center point, and that will essentially be like the reference range. I know for some tests, though, like hemoglobin A1C, some of the tests are developed by actually looking at a chart of like where increased in poor health outcomes start to go up sharply. So like you might say at this particular level of A1C or fasting glucose, we don't see very many complications like stroke or heart attack. And once that curve starts to go up very sharply, like that's when it will be called like the diagnostic threshold. The issue with that and why I've actually presented totally different ranges in my book, which are optimal ranges compared to the normal ranges, is because when you look at those curves of like when risk starts going up for whatever, all-cause mortality, metabolic disease, type 2 diabetes, stroke, whatever the endpoint is that they're looking at to create thresholds, oftentimes the curve starts going up quite sharply before it takes a really, really sharp uphill turn. And I'm like, I don't want to be caught in that area where it's starting to go up, but it might have not reached that really sharp increase. So I'm like, I'd rather be at the point where the risk is basically close to zero. That's where I want to stay. I don't want to stay in the part where it's rising. And the fact that that's not mentioned to people, and the fact that you could be actually pretty far on this spectrum of increased risk, but because you haven't met some cutoff point to where it really starts going up even more sharply, that you're going to be told that you're totally fine, I think that's a travesty. I think it's a total travesty. And so I think people becoming familiar with more optimal ranges is critical, like specifically around fasting glucose. Like, we know that if your fasting glucose is between 70 and 85, your risk of developing future cardiometabolic diseases is so much lower than if your fasting glucose is like 99. Both are in the normal range, but one person's going to be doing, you know, so much more poorly in their life, but they are not going to be told that because of the way the reference ranges are right now. A similar one to that, that really I just, in the book, I'm like, you got to shoot for the lowest number possible is CRP, inflammatory marker. They basically will say now that below one is optimal and between one and three is sort of moderate risk, and above three, it becomes really problematic. But the best research I could find was that you actually want it to be 0.36 or below. So not just less than three, not less than one, but less than 0.36. So like, why aren't we being told this? Because everyone should know where to point their arrow. Like, doctors should be giving just straight facts, and then patients can choose what they want to do with that. But we should not be lumping people into big categories where within that category, some people are going to have much higher risk than others. People who might have done something about it if they'd known.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And they're also not even taking in consideration age in these lab ranges. So it's just either male or female. So it's like, okay, well, if I'm 30, what should my numbers be? And there is just none of that. I'm so excited because, you know, I've been doing super comprehensive labs, everything, for so long. And I'm like, you know, I have all the optimal ranges for these super comprehensive, but also basic female specific labs. And so I'm going to be sharing all of my labs in the next couple of weeks and kind of just making that publicly available. So, but I agree, but it's not easy for people to access what the optimal ranges are.
It's not. No, I mean, you really have to do it by either like listening to podcasts, going to like the blogs of your favorite functional medicine doctors. I remember when I was leaving conventional healthcare and going down the more like functional medicine training route, I was getting my information from like Dr. Will Cole's blog and Dr. Chris Kresser's blog and Dr. Mark Hyman's blog and like Isabella Wentz about thyroid hormones. And this was now years and years ago. And I have like my bookshelf next to me, just sticky notes everywhere. You are literally searching for this information yourself. And what was so fun about writing this book was like really going and doing all that research for myself. The Levels blog has, I think our most popular blog post is the ultimate guide to your understanding your metabolic lab tests, because people are so desperate. And we literally say, print this out and sit down with your lab results and read the explanations and look at the optimal ranges. And for that, what we did is we looked at both the research, but also just did consensus expert opinion from the top metabolic health thought leaders in the world. People like Dr. Rob Lustig, Dr. Dom D'Agostino, Dr. Ben Bickman, Dr. Sarah Gottfried, Terry Walls, Mark Hyman, and just took all of their thoughts and put it together. But how crazy it is that like that's the way we're piecing together what optimal health looks like these days. It's really strange.
It is really strange. And it's even more strange that, and I was operating under the same understanding that the labs essentially, yeah, the mean of the people that go to the labs, but that's actually even worse because who goes to labs mostly? This is sick people and elderly people. So, I mean, why is it appropriate to benchmark being healthy and looking at labs to try to achieve health against, you know, that population? That's just not fair.
I know. Totally.
So much great information about metabolic health. But now we know that mental health is the number one disability worldwide, right?
That sounds right. Yeah. I did not actually know that that's the case, but that's incredible.
Yeah. So what is your approach to that in good energy?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the key thing for people to realize is that the brain is the most energy hungry organ in the whole body, right? It uses 20% of our body's energy and it's about 2% of the body's weight. So it's obviously doing such incredible complex processing, and every single one of those cells, those incredible amount of cells in the brain, they need energy to function properly. So I think one of the reasons why rampant metabolic dysfunction is so closely linked with so many of the mental health and neurodegenerative, neurodevelopmental diseases that we're seeing today is because, of course, where is an energy problem going to show up early and show up most potently? It's going to show up in the organ that needs the most energy. So I think it's both just astounding how bad the situation is, the rates of mental health issues, up 40% of women with a diagnosis of depression or anxiety in their lifetime. I mean, it's out of control. Like I said, 40% of 18-year-olds have reported some type of mental health diagnosis. Like it's huge numbers in like literally the wealthiest country in the world. And what's amazing about what we know about the basic science today is that so many of these conditions across the spectrum are fundamentally either caused by directly or accelerated by metabolic dysfunction, which creates an amazing opportunity for us because that's something that we can do something about. We can absolutely optimize the energy production pathways of the brain by doing everything we can to support the quantity, quality, and function of our mitochondria. So obviously, like probably the best book written on this in the last couple of years is I think the amazing book by Dr. Chris Palmer called Brain Energy, which really presents like a unifying theory of how these conditions are rooted in metabolic dysfunction. It is truly across the lifespan that we're seeing this from, you know, from childhood illnesses like ADHD, autism, depression, anxiety in children to midlife with migraines, headaches, fibromyalgia, brain fog, depression, anxiety, other mental health diagnoses, bipolar to older age with early dementia, with Parkinson's, with even the autoimmune diseases that affect the brain, like multiple sclerosis. Every single disease I just mentioned has very strong basic science to suggest that it is problems with how the mitochondria are working that is in some way driving or directly causing those diseases. So that's just an opportunity area for everyone because it can feel so incredibly hopeless when these things are happening and so scary. But that's just a huge opportunity for us, I think.
Absolutely. I was listening to an interview that you did earlier, and what is the number? How much food do people eat throughout their life?
70 metric tons.
And do you know what the stat is of currently how much of the American diet is ultra processed or processed food?
About 60% for adults and close to 70% for children.
I mean, it's astounding. I mean, it's just so wild to me that we're not having a massive focus on what you eat every single day and just how you move your body.
Yeah. Yeah. In my book, I talk about a time in my life, sort of the one time in my life I've really dealt with, I think, overt mental health issues was when I was a surgical resident and my life was just so out of control, just chronic stress, up all the time, staying up multiple nights per week on call, eating cafeteria food, not exercising, not seeing the sun, all the things that, you know, artificial light 24 hours a day, circadian rhythms out the window, complete metabolic mayhem. And I, of course, went to the doctor and I'm like, you know, I'm dealing with all these symptoms because my body's falling apart, obviously, because I had become totally metabolically dysfunctional. I had IBS, I had acne, I had pain, I had depression. And of course, each of the doctors was like, well, here's loperamide for your IBS, and here's doxycycline for your acne, and here's Flexeril for your neck pain. And, you know, I took none of it because I had a sense. Even then, I didn't understand the metabolic framework then. But like, I remember when in doing the research of this book, there were such astounding stats like, I'm just going to read to you from some of these things. Like one study showed that every additional 18 milligrams per deciliter of fasting glucose was associated with a 37% increased rate of developing depression. So just 18 milligram per deciliter increase in fasting glucose, and you were almost a 40% higher likelihood of depression. For every 1 unit increase in the triglyceride to HDL ratio, people had an 89% higher chance of the risk of depression. So I'm like, stepping back and reflecting, I'm like, if a doctor had ever told me, or if I had ever learned as a doctor to tell others, that these simple biomarkers that are metabolic biomarkers are so deeply connected to the suffering that you're feeling, if you could clearly tell a patient that, I believe that that patient would work to improve it. And the issue is that we're not speaking clearly about these things. We're not only not learning them, but we're not, I think people are very afraid to talk frankly about this to people. Like, you got to bring down your blood sugar. Like, we need to get, can you imagine an average psychiatrist with a patient with depression in their office saying, we're going to get you a continuous glucose monitor. We are going to be checking your triglyceride, HDL, insulin, glucose, inflammatory markers every 3 months until they're moving in the right direction. We're going to get you a functional medicine nutritionist and all of these things. And we're going to get you a trainer so that you start to like build more functional mitochondria so you can actually work through that glucose. Because like we talked about earlier, that fasting glucose is a signal that the body is having trouble making energy for its cells. Because when the body is having trouble converting food energy to cellular energy, it puts up the insulin resistance block because it can't bring more glucose into the cell. And that's when that fasting glucose rises. So even though it just sounds like this biomarker that I feel like we just kind of gloss over, it's like, oh, glucose. But what does it really mean? It means there's a problem with how the cell is making energy. And of course, a brain cell not making energy properly is going to express symptoms. And one of the ways it expresses those symptoms is mood issues. And then of course, our mental health issues are deeply related to our microbiome as well, because our microbiome makes so many of the neurotransmitters that ultimately control our mood and our motivation and all aspects of our mental health. And those two things are so tightly linked, because frequently people with the metabolic problems also have microbiome problems, because the same things that hurt our microbiome, like ultra-processed foods and synthetic toxins that we're putting in and on our bodies, chronic stress, not exercising, those things all affect the microbiome. They all affect our mitochondria. And then, of course, they affect the way the microbiome talks to our mitochondria. So we just need to be speaking plainly and like bringing this research to our practice. But it takes 17 years, so they say, for some of this basic science research to make it into our practice guidelines. And I think we're kind of in the middle of that right now, where like we're still practicing outdated medicine that's so much based on diagnosis drug, and so many patients are getting lost in the middle of that. And on top of that, we have a very pervasive culture of doctors thinking that patients don't want to do hard things like work out and eat healthy. But I think part of the reason that doctors might be having that experience is because if you're a patient going to the doctor's office right now, the doctors are not all as one unit saying, you guys need to focus on metabolic health. Everyone needs to be lifting weights. Everyone needs to be walking multiple hours per day, whether it's on a treadmill desk or elsewhere. Everyone needs morning sunlight. Everyone needs to turn the lights off or dim the lights after dark. Everyone needs to be doing the work to manage their chronic stress. Everyone needs to be sleeping in a dark room uninterrupted. If the whole medical system, from the NIH to the FDA to the USDA to schools to doctors, were saying that, I think everyone would do it. But there's instead this creation of mass confusion of different dietary strategies and different workout strategies, and everyone's confused. So of course, a lot of patients probably don't end up being successful because they're getting 20 different messages and having many doctors probably say it's not even important. So that's a real thing I really want to see from our entire health community from the top down, is just like a real clarity and moral leadership on saying these things in unison and not getting into the quibbling of the details, but really just focusing on the basics that apply to anyone. Unprocessed food, no added sugar, no refined grains, no seed oils. Don't care what you eat, vegan or carnivore, Needs to be real food, not covered in pesticides, no refined sugars, grains, seed oils. You got to move your body. You got to do it every day. You got to do it most of the day. I don't care what you do. I don't care if it's zone two. I don't care if it's HIIT. I don't care if it's walking. I don't care if it's yoga. I would love for everyone to lift weights, but just move your body most of the day somehow. Sleep. Just sleep. Like, just make sure you're getting 7 or 8 hours more. Make your room quiet. Make it dark. Like, find a way to relax. I don't care how you do it. Meditation, psychedelics, therapy, groups, friends, go in nature, read Rumi, like write in your journal. You got to just like figure, you do have to figure out stress and get rid of all the toxins in your home, personal care products, your water, your air, et cetera. Like, that all sounds complicated, but I think those are principles that can apply to really like any person's preferences or strategies. And like, no one's saying that on the like top level. Like,
no.
And so I think that that's where like, that's where the system really needs to go.
I agree completely. I mean, food is obviously a huge issue, but you know, the toxic burdens are just unbelievable. And yeah. I truly rarely hear anyone even talk about this right now.
Yeah. The toxins.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so interesting. I think there was a great paper that came out about a year and a half ago about this concept of obesogens. Rob Lustig was one of the authors on the paper, who's a dear friend and one of the Levels advisors and a professor emeritus of neuroendocrinology at UCSF. And it was a very like legitimate paper. It was like 100 pages. And it basically talked about how, well, he talks about how he thinks 15% of the metabolic disease epidemic is directly related to these toxic exposures. Like a full 15% of everything we're seeing across the metabolic spectrum is just from these toxins. There have been 80,000 plus synthetic toxins that have entered our food, water, air, homes, personal care products over the past 50 years, most of which have never been tested for safety in humans, and almost none of which have been tested together for their synergistic negative effects in humans. And, you know, you hear about how like the average woman's putting like over 100 chemicals per day on her body just from the products she's using. So this is huge. And then you talk about, a lot of us aren't filtering our water. Very few of us are filtering our air. And the average American is indoors 93% of a 24-hour period. And indoor air is more polluted than outdoor air. So you combine all this together and it's sort of unbelievable to think about how much strain this is on our cells, because anything you're putting in or on your body has to process. And it's not like it magically disappears. It's going into this machine and something has to happen with it. And anything we're doing to divert our attention from metabolic health and just optimal thriving is going to hurt our functioning. And we're spending, I can't even imagine how much energy the body is spending with all its enzymes and with all its antioxidant pathways and the you know, even the ways we're having to clean up genetic mutations inside our cells through these, the way these toxins are impacting, like so much work being diverted from thriving towards just like detoxification and the alarm that the body feels from these toxins. And no one's looking out, literally no one's looking out for us. As there's like a generally recognized as safe GRAS label that can go on some of these chemicals, which is essentially the company that manufactures this, supplies the data and pulls the data for the safety. So there's a huge compromise of the integrity of the data, and it doesn't even need to have GRAS status to be put into market. So I think that the safest thing to do is to, of course, buy all as clean home care products as you can, whether it's cleaning supplies or personal care products, shampoo, deodorant, toothpaste, makeup, all of it, as clean and simple as possible. And obviously filter your water with a really high quality filter. If you can filter your air, that's great as well. And then organic food as much as possible. And then an easy one that people forget about is just like get outside into nature more, because we're spending about 7% of our days outdoors and we should be trying to increase that to like 30-40 at least percent of our time outdoors breathing fresh air, hopefully not around highways or lots of cars. So yeah, the paper, the obesogens paper, is fascinating because it talks about the many different mechanistic links of how these chemicals directly impair our metabolic function and therefore literally cause obesity. It was interesting because the paper focused on the causation of obesity by toxic chemicals, but I think more broadly we can look at that as the induction of metabolic strain and disease. And it did it. It does it through the way it impacts the microbiome. It does it through the way it impacts epigenetics. It does it through the way it affects cell receptors and direct genotoxic or mitochondrial toxic effects. So there's all these different ways these toxins are hurting us, and together we're being crushed. So I like to come at health very much from a standpoint of like compassion for my cells. Like these are little machines that when they get what they need and when they're not overburdened, they will give me the most beautiful, thriving, limitless life possible. And it's my job as the self, as the person who is the caretaker of these 40 trillion cells, to protect them from poison. And so that's what I'm doing when I go to the farmer's market. That's what I'm doing when I use coconut oil to take my makeup off as opposed to a chemical makeup remover. Like that's what I'm doing when I'm not painting my nails. That's what I'm doing when I'm using an unscented shampoo. That's what I'm doing when I'm using glass Tupperware. I'm protecting my cells that I'm the guardian of from poison. And I think we should look at it that way because, again, when we give them what they want, what they're expecting, and we don't overburden them with toxins, our lives become very healthy and magically easier. And so that's the work we have to do.
I agree. I have been so particular about essentially every toxin, you know, organic bed, air doctors everywhere, filtered water, filtered shower water. And it works because we see total toxic burden tests all the time. So that's testing for heavy metals, environmental toxins, mold, mycotoxins, molds and mycotoxins. And it's a super comprehensive test. I have like two toxins in the medium range, zero toxins in the high range. So if you really are committed, and it's so sad too, because like I know that the rates of autoimmunity, and I can't say this for sure, but I feel as if toxins have such a huge impact on that. And we know that women have autoimmune issues more than men. And if you just think about it on a really basic level, well, if women are exposed to all of the personal care products, they're leaving the house with 1 to 200, you know, toxic chemicals on their body. I mean, it makes sense that the numbers would present that way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that when you look at what's happening with women, it's almost like it's like the canary in the coal mine. Like for a lot of these things, you've got women really expressing higher rates of a lot of these diseases that we now know are related to metabolic dysfunction, higher rates of depression, higher rates of anxiety, higher rates of autoimmune diseases after menopause, higher rates of diabetes, obesity, and Alzheimer's dementia, all linked to metabolic issues. And there are just, now that we know a lot about what can hurt the mitochondria, that kind of becomes clear. Like we've got the toxins that, based on what, you know, you're just talking about and what I see as well, like probably higher burden in our modern world with like women, given all the things they're putting on their body that have been normalized, and then potentially being around home care products more and like cleaning solutions and cleaning supplies like that. It's like, that's a lot to be exposed to every single day. And then there's research on sort of higher levels of stress and trauma for women in this particular part of the world at this time in human history. And then that, of course, directly leads to changes in physiology that we know affect all the hallmarks of bad energy. Chronic stress, chronic fear directly feeds into oxidative stress. It directly feeds into mitochondrial dysfunction. It directly feeds into chronic inflammation. It activates the cell danger response in the mitochondria. So the stress, the toxins, those seem to be, and I think also there's some evidence that women need a little bit more sleep than men. And so with the decline of sleep over the past 100 years, like we're getting about 2 hours less sleep per year. I mean, 2 hours less sleep per day than we were about 100 years ago from the research that we have on that. you can see how it could potentially disproportionately affect women, since a lot of that is funneling straight through mitochondrial health. But those are assumptions. You know, I'm just sort of assuming that the food probably is pretty similar between men and women. Hard to know, but the sleep, the toxins, and the chronic stress and trauma feel like they could be somewhat differentiated. So,
yeah, no, absolutely. I think that, and then also the link to fertility. I'm so sad of where we're at right now. It's really disheartening, but I'm sure that that's also linked to metabolic health. I mean, obviously, yeah. I mean, PCOS and metabolic health, super connected.
Oh, yeah, so connected. This is one of the things. I mean, we're both in the phases of our life where I feel like we're both thinking a lot about these things, like being in our 30s. And this is where I think the conversation just gets like so wacky, because like, if you literally think about what's happening with fertility right now, like if things don't change, like there's actually a situation in which like we may not be able to like reproduce as a species, really. Like infertility is going up about 1%. Like we're seeing infertility rates go up about 1% per year and sperm counts declining about 1% per year. So it's like, what are we sort of thinking is going to happen here? And yeah, with so much of the evidence showing that this is deeply related to metabolic dysfunction, which is totally modifiable, we got to realize like we got ourselves in this mess over the course of a generation. We can easily get ourselves out of this, but we have to focus the arrow on the right issue. Like this is not, we don't have an issue of not having enough assisted reproductive technology. We have an issue of metabolically unhealthy bodies. And I think from the standpoint of, the energy sort of theory of things, it makes sense. Like a mother to, well, I one thing to mention that I think is actually something that I think people don't realize. I think a lot of people understand that sperm decline and infertility in women are both related to metabolic dysfunction. So polycystic ovarian syndrome, which is the number one cause of infertility in women in the United States, affecting up to 25% of women worldwide, that is directly a metabolic disease. It's associated with 80% of women with PCOS are dealing with obesity, not everyone, but many. And more than half of women with PCOS will have type 2 diabetes by the time they're 40. So it's very linked. And the physiology of that is that high insulin levels in the body, the hyperinsulinemia, is driving the ovarian cells, the ovarian theca cells, to make more testosterone. And when the ovaries make more testosterone than they should, it really perturbs the whole delicate balance of sex hormones that lead to healthy ovulation and ultimately a successful pregnancy. For men, with 74% of men being overweight or obese in the country, and belly fat, visceral fat, actually can act as a hormone converting organ. So the fat can turn the testosterone to estrogen. So you've got the men essentially use their fat is converting testosterone to estrogen. In women, you've got their ovaries making more testosterone. Both are impacting the delicate balance of hormones that leads to healthy ovulation and healthy sperm production. Both are very much linked to what we're eating and what we're doing and how our mitochondria are functioning. So that makes a lot of sense on the front end of pregnancy. But then when you actually look at what's happening during pregnancy, the placenta is a very energy hungry organ. So we develop this whole new organ during pregnancy, the placenta, and that takes a lot of energy. This is like a very, very complex organ that does, you know, oxygen exchange and nutrient exchange. And there's a lot of balance of metabolism and hormones that's involved in placental development. And placental dysfunction is one of the key causes of miscarriage. And we also know that miscarriage rates are going up quite a bit. And miscarriage rates are higher for women that have metabolic diseases. So the more features of metabolic syndrome that someone has, the higher the odds ratio of placental dysfunction and fetal death. And there's an odds ratio. This is one of the highest odds ratios I saw in writing this book, an odds ratio of 7.7 for placental dysfunction in women with 3 to 4 of the metabolic syndrome features. And the metabolic syndrome features are the things I mentioned earlier, the high triglycerides, low HDL, high fasting glucose, large waist circumference, high blood pressure. And the reason for why this is thought is because if you have metabolic imbalances in the placenta, it can lead to fetal death because it's going to have problems with how you build blood vessels in the placenta, like how oxygen and nutrients are being delivered. So that's really pretty, I would say that feels so devastating because it's even for the women who are able to eventually get pregnant, there's a higher risk of these terrible outcomes if there's underlying metabolic issues. You look at gestational diabetes, the condition has risen 30% since 2016. That's like the last less than 10 years, it's risen 30%. A lot of that is because of lifestyle issues. And then miscarriage rates have risen 10% over the last 10 years. So just like pretty devastating statistics. And it's so sensitive and it's something that is going to, it causes so much pain and hardship for people. I just wish the information were out there even more clearly that like this is a modifiable thing that we can do to make these really painful outcomes much less likelihood. But there, you know, again, people aren't speaking clearly at the doctor's office about what needs to be done to do that. How many primary care doctors are telling their 32-year-old patient to go lift weights 3 days a week? Probably zero, you know?
Maybe a few, I agree. It's complex and it is so sad because, you know, I've been blessed to like witness firsthand that PCOS, so many of these conditions can actually pretty quickly, if you adhere to the program, be substantially impacted and reversed. And it's just like, if there was just more education in doctor's visits, because we know that like, you know, standard Western medicine reaches the most people because it's covered by insurance and so on and so forth. If there was just a little bit more education, it would just change so many lives.
Yeah. So, yeah.
That's why I'm so glad we have your book and you. And it's been such a pleasure to have you on my podcast today.
It's always so good to see you. The work you're doing is so, so amazing. And thank you so much for having me on and sharing about this.
Oh, absolutely. And I can't wait to see you soon.
Yes, 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 yes. Thank you, Kayla.
Of course.
Hacking was created and is hosted by Kayla Barnes. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and views expressed on this podcast are not medical advice. This podcast, including Kayla Barnes, does not accept responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of the information contained herein. Opinions of their guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. If you think you have a medical issue, consult a licensed physician.